Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome once again to Inside Scoop Live. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and today, author Phyllis Zimbler-Miller is here to talk about her just-released book, Mrs. Lieutenant, a Sharon Gold novel, which I actually have just heard is a semi-finalist in the Amazon Breakthrough Novel Award. Set against the backdrop of the Vietnam War, this novel takes place from May to July in 1970, and it's based on the first few months that Phyllis was a new Mrs. Lieutenant. Originally from Elgin, Illinois, Phyllis earned her BA in journalism from Michigan State University, where she met her husband. After his 2 years of active duty, they lived in Philadelphia, where she worked as a journalist and then earned an MBA from the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania before they moved to Los Angeles. Phyllis also co-authored a previous book, a Jewish holiday book, titled Seasons for Celebration, which was published in 1992 and has just been released as a second edition. She is currently working on a success guide for teens titled Flipping Burgers and Beyond, and her website is www.mrslieutenant.com. So I'm just so happy to have Phyllis on the phone today. Thanks for joining us today, Phyllis.
I really appreciate being here.
Well, great. And congratulations on your new book. This must be very exciting for you.
Yes, a book that's been 38 years in the making.
Well, I was just going to say it has been a very long time coming. So why publish it now after, you know, almost 40 years after the real life event?
It took me a long time to separate the personal from the story and also to learn from going to being a journalist, nothing but the facts, to being a novelist, where I have to let go of myself and really fictionalize the story.
What did you have to do to prepare yourself to actually write this novel?
I took tons of classes at UCLA Extension and bought book after book from the Writer's Digest books and, you know, learning point of view. It took me a long time to decide the format of the four voices and how to do those stories.
So it was a lot of writing, a lot of editing. Did you have a lot of copies out to friends and getting their critiques on it?
Yes, and something interesting happened. People really liked it, and they kept saying something is missing. So I finally hired an editorial consultant. No editing, nothing, just to figure out the one thing that was missing. And he did. He's a genius.
Really? And you got it in there, and it's made all the difference?
Right. It was making it really clear, the sequence of events, kind of who was on base and who's talking, and the relationship as to what point in the story that event took place.
Oh, so it was a timeline then.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine in a story such as this, that would be very important.
That's right. And that's why each chapter actually has a date at the top, kind of help everyone keep it in mind how we're moving along in the story.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, I wanted to know about that. I'm actually going to leave that for a little later on because there's another thing that you add into the beginnings of your chapters too. So let's have a little build up before we get to that, dive right into it. So, okay, tell us, the book is based on your own experiences as a new Mrs. Lieutenant, and, you know, your website, you have the original documents, a lot of the information from way back when. Why, it's interesting that you chose to write this as a novel and not just a plain nonfiction book. Why did you decide to do that?
Because I wanted to protect the innocent. These are fictional characters, but they're all pieces of real people, kind of mixed up together, and also events that happened later in our Army career, put into Fort Knox, and I just thought I wanted to make sure I was protecting people's identity.
Okay.
Even this much after the fact.
So you actually, it's not accurate. It's not completely accurate from what I understand. Like you've taken some of the timeline a little bit out of context.
The timeline's accurate, and it's very much the events are true. It's just some of the people's backstories. For example, the African-American character that is sort of the beginning of this, of, you know, where I took off from, did something that I needed to find an explanation for. So I literally wrote the explanation of an action that she did that I could never understand.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Okay, so tell talking about four women in this book. Let's get readers up to date on what this book is about, who these four women are, and what they're going through.
Okay, let's start with the fact that this book starts on the day in May 1970 when Ohio National Guard shot and killed four students at Kent State University during a Vietnam War protest. Nixon has just announced on April 30th, 4 days before, that he's going to go into Cambodia, so he's widening the war, and the Vietnam War is very unpopular. And yet, the four women are coming to Fort Knox with their husbands, all of whom were in ROTC in college, which is Reserve Officer Training Corps. So you train during college and then you serve at least 2 years in the Army as officers. But the other thing to keep in mind is that this is in April of May of 1970. In December of 1969 was the first lottery for draft. There was a draft in Vietnam. Everyone was eligible, all males over 18. And, for example, my husband's number was 16. So he looked like a genius that he was already an officer in the Army rather than going in as an enlisted man. So that's kind of the backdrop. So the four men are coming to go to Armor Officers Basic. They've already had officer training. Now they're doing a combat arms, you know, tanks. That's what armor means.
Mm-hmm.
That's the armor school. They will spend 9 weeks together. And then some of them are actually armor officers. They will just go on to their next permanent stations. Sharon's husband and Donna's husband are military intelligence officers. They have to do combat arms first, and then they'll go on to Fort Holabird for military intelligence training. All are expecting to go to Vietnam, and that's what the wives fear.
Okay, and then the wives are there at Fort Knox. What was the atmosphere like at Fort Knox in contrast to basically the rest of the country and to where you were coming in from?
It was like summer camp. The war wasn't really discussed.
Wow.
But one thing I have to add, although the Army did not tell us that we could come, that was the strangest thing. I just wouldn't leave my husband. We were newly married.
Mm-hmm.
So I came to Fort Knox, and we went to the housing office, and we were given off-base housing possibilities. That's the strangest thing. Then we found out a few days later that there was actually training for us new Army officers' wives, even though the Army hadn't told their husbands that they could bring us. So we went to these official functions,
mm-hmm.
and then we were off-base. So we had kind of a dual world.
That must have been very strange for you.
Yes. Very strange.
Why wouldn't more women join their husbands like you did?
Well, there were several. That's what the book is about.
Mm-hmm.
But there were several. We became very friendly with a couple, when we went to Munich, Germany afterwards, and she didn't go because the Army didn't say she could go to Fort Knox.
But
I just wasn't leaving my husband.
Well, good for you. How long had you been married at that point?
6 months.
6 months. Mm. So how... did you know that he wanted to enlist in the war? What was the buildup? Because from what I understand, you weren't a big fan of the war.
That's the fictional part.
Okay.
I made Sharon, who's the closest character to me, anti-war protester because I wanted to talk about the backdrop of anti-war protests.
Okay.
I was apolitical. My head was so deep in the sand, I just ignored it all, including when my husband... to be told me on our third date that he was going to Vietnam. I just managed to totally block that.
Mm-hmm. What were his motivations? What did he think of the war and what was going on?
He believed that if his country was at war, that he had a patriotic duty to defend it. His grandfather, who had been an immigrant from Russia, was in World War I. His father was fought in Europe in World War II. He thought the war was right to stop communism, but he didn't think the way it was being handled was right.
Mm. And so what happened when he actually did go to Vietnam? I mean, did he convey that to you at that point when he was
in? He didn't go.
Oh.
Part of the kind of, I'll probably touch the question, it's probably the kind of sequence of events that happened and that he didn't end up going. And part of it is covered in the book.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When officers are given a chance, they were sort of officers. The Army offered. The ROTC officers was a 2-year commitment. If they would volunteer for at least a third year, they would postpone Vietnam for a year.
Oh, isn't that interesting? How did you feel about that?
Well, I was thrilled. We were going to get to go to Europe for a year.
Mm-hmm.
Usually you only get to go to Europe with your husband with housing if your husband's a career officer and he gets 3 years, you know, then it's a 3-year post.
Mm.
But I'll never forget. I told my mother, and she said, but Europe's so far away. And I said, Vietnam is a lot farther.
Mm-hmm. And much more dangerous.
I still have these emotions today. It's funny because it was a very emotional time, but we wives didn't really talk about it with each other.
Well, I was wondering about that. If when you were at Fort Knox and you were basically your peer group and your support system really was the other women there, if you did share your deepest feelings or if you actually hid your fear.
The only thing I remember is that the woman that I shared a car with in carpooling said that she would make a will and if her husband was going to Vietnam, and I said why, and she said because she thought that if he died in Vietnam without a will, that she might not get anything, that his parents would take everything.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, I was 22 years old, and it was like total shock. I had just turned 22.
That's young.
The only mention besides one other thing that's revealed in the book, which I cannot tell you. But other than that, we didn't talk about it.
Mm-hmm. That must have been really, I mean, that's so fascinating just to kind of to block out the obvious like that. And so what did you do? You must have had to do something with your mind, with your thoughts, just every day to basically to not think about that. How did you keep yourself busy and away from those thoughts?
The person I carpooled with, she and I went, once Memorial Day came, we went to the swim pool, the officer's swim club every day.
Mm-hmm.
And I read books that I had, and we went to get-togethers of the AOB class at the officer's club. And, you know, that's where I actually, officers outside AOB told me things that the only two examples I know. One time I was sitting next to a guy, and I asked him, are you a member of this AOB class? And he said, no, I just got that from NAM. And I said, oh, what did you do there? He said, I was in the Phoenix program. I said, do you know what that is? I said, no. He said, we assassinate Viet Cong officials. And, you know, as an officer's wife, you say nothing because everything could hurt your husband. And then the time I learned about fragging, Vietnam enlisted men killed their own officers, and that was called fragging. They would literally throw grenades into the tents and kill their officers.
And why would they do that?
Because they were a drafted army. There was a great deal of drugs, and if they thought that their officer was getting them risking their lives, that he wasn't good at what he was doing, the next one might be better.
Is that right? That's pretty controversial subject matter right there. I mean, I've never heard that before.
Not something talked about a lot, but I'm pretty sure it was at the officers' club that another officer told me.
Wow. So hearing that, what went through your mind when you heard that?
I was very relieved that my husband had just got, I didn't know at this time he wasn't going to Vietnam, but that he was a military intelligence officer. Because he's a very smart guy, but he's not great at outdoor sports. He would have been he was supposed to be a second lieutenant in infantry and go to Vietnam. And they had the highest death rate, second lieutenants in infantry, in Vietnam at the time. And I knew my husband would die. He just, you know, he wasn't really good at those kind of skills, like hunting and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So at that moment, I was thrilled that he had finally managed to get a transfer to military intelligence.
Oh.
So at least he had a chance to survive in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. So he never went to Vietnam. How long did he stay in the military?
He ended up only having to serve, 2 years and I think 4 days, and he knows the number of hours.
Mm.
But he had a commitment of 3 years at one point, and it was rolled back.
So tell us about Fort Knox a little bit. What were the most surprising things to you when you first got to Fort Knox for when your husband was attending the Armor Officers Basic?
Two things that really stand out. One was the commissary, that's the Army grocery store, didn't have any beef. They had chicken and pork. And we're Jewish, and we didn't keep kosher then. We keep kosher now, but we didn't eat pork. So I even went to a grocery store near the fort, and there wasn't any beef. So we used to go to Louisville, that's how it's pronounced, Louisville, see my grandparents, and go to a store that sold kosher frozen meat from Philadelphia on Sunday. That's how we got beef. That was like a shock. Couldn't get beef. The other thing was the class difference. When we went to get housing, I'll never forget this. You know, we have a list of where you can rent off-base housing. We go up to the door. Mitch is wearing his uniform. And a man comes to the door. He's in his 50s, and he looks at my husband, and he says, I'm sorry, sir, you wouldn't be comfortable here. My husband says, well, we haven't even seen it yet. He said, I'm sorry, sir, and he closed the door. He said, Mitch, I don't understand what's happening. He said, he wouldn't rent to me. I'm an officer. He called me, and he would be uncomfortable if I lived in his home. I said, well, how did you know that? Because he called me sir. Oh, and that, again, was such a shock to class differences.
Mm-hmm.
And that happened. There are two very funny stories. Funny is not exactly the word. Because my husband's car had a sticker, a student sticker, and not an officer sticker,
mm-hmm.
we twice were the MPs tried to take action against my husband because they thought he was an enlisted man, and when they realized he wasn't, they reversed their decision.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, one was we were at a picnic with all other officers, and everyone was parked illegally. They were only going to give my husband's car a ticket because he was an enlisted man, so he proved he was an officer.
Mm-hmm.
The other time we were coming back to Fort Knox at night, probably to the officers' club, we had a teeny little Fiat Spider. We were stopped because a shipment of rifles had been stolen from Fort Knox that day. First of all, we were coming in. The Fiat wouldn't have enough room for one rifle, but that's beside the point. They made him get out of the car to inspect the car. And when they realized he was an officer, they apologized. They were only inspecting enlisted men's cars. Which I, to this day, find bizarre.
That is very strange, isn't it?
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Established in 1998, Rebecca's Reads is a book review and publicity service serving a large reading audience as well as a wide community of authors, publishers, publicists, and buyers and sellers. They offer reviews of recently published books as well as chapter readings, teasers, and videos to help you decide what book you would like to read next. Their insightful author interviews take connecting reader and author one step further, and if you decide you would like to purchase a book, an easy-to-navigate link will allow you to purchase the book immediately online. For the authors, publicists, and publishers, Rebecca's Reads has a variety of publicity services to help them market their books to their reading audience. Their services are budget-friendly and effective. For buyers and sellers, they have a monthly list of current reviews in the Book Review Index for easy browsing, as they know your time is precious and efficiency is a priority. Be sure to visit RebeccasReads.com and browse around their new space. Whatever your literary need, this user-friendly website may be just what you're looking for. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Just to remind you, I'm talking today with Phyllis Simbler Miller, author of Mrs. Lieutenant, a Sharon Gold novel. You can find out more about Phyllis through her website, www.mrslieutenant.com. How big is Fort Knox? How many people lived on that base?
I actually don't know. It's it's a very widespread one, meaning, you know, Kentucky, green grass and low-slung buildings. And besides, I never went to the troop area, as my fictional character explains. I thought I made something up for the book that was actually true. So the only time I really went to the post was to go to the PX, Post Exchange. That's where they sold towels and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And to go to the events to be trained to be an officer's wife, which were usually at the quarters, that means the housing place, of high-ranking senior officer's wife.
So tell us a little bit about that training, because this is a very, very interesting aspect to the story that I'm sure a lot of people will find very surprising. So tell us a little bit about that.
It was suggested that we buy this booklet called Mrs. Lieutenant. I have it in front of me. It cost $1. It's a booklet, and it had the rules and regulations of what we should do to be proper officer's wife and to make sure that we helped our husbands and not hinder them. So it had such mundane things as social functions, which aren't so mundane, but the size of your calling card, how to serve tea. I mean, I'm looking through it now, how to write a thank you note. Listen to just this is one example. Tea. Should I place doilies or cloth on a sandwich tray? Neither. The sandwiches should be placed directly on the tray.
God.
I find that bizarre. I would have thought the answer should have been the opposite.
Yes. So it's basically the etiquette that was expected of you.
Exactly.
Wow. So, what did you think when you got that booklet and found out that was what was being expected?
You know, I don't know what I thought, because I know that my husband believed that if he kept his brass, that's his insignia shined and his boots shined and his hair cut short, that he would be kind of left alone. He had, say, some anti-Semitism when he went to ROT summer camp. So I knew that I wasn't supposed to stand up, but I did take a big risk when I volunteered to be the entertainment chair for the graduation luncheon, and instead of doing the fashion show or etiquette lesson they expected, I wrote a skit satirizing the Army. And I have it right here in my terrible handwriting. Actually, in those days, I could write nicely. And I did put it in 1776 to protect people.
You were a little bit rebellious, I think.
Yeah. So obviously, that is a clue to what I must have thought.
Yeah. Gosh, it's so... Did you talk with other women at that time about maybe some of the bizarre nature of some of that, some of what was expected of you?
I can't really remember talking about it because now my fictional characters are in my head. But I will tell you, one of my first experiences of talking about culture shock is that my next-door neighbor, where we found housing, asked me to go to another person's apartment. And when we walked in, she had a huge wedding portrait on the wall. Remember, these were furnished temporary apartments. Our husbands were only going to be there 9 weeks. She, her husband was in a different group, you know, like 2 weeks ahead, but basically the same training. She was from the South. They had pulled a trailer behind them because she had to take the wedding portrait and her silver. And she wanted her husband to go to Vietnam because if he wanted to have a career, he needed to have a combat tour. And that whole, you know, silver, you know, good silver, your wedding portrait, your husband serving in Vietnam as part of a career was so alien to me.
That's interesting. You know, with these four women that you have in your book, they cross different racial and cultural lines. So what was it like for you to get to know these women? Was there any sort of reference in your life previous to Fort Knox that you could, you know, kind of relate to the women that you met there? And how does the contrast of these racial and cultural divides actually add to this novel and the message you're trying to get across?
Very good question. As opposed to my fictional character, I grew up in a small town where I was always the only Jewish kid in my class until high school. And there were two boys, but within 400 students in a class, I never had any class with them. So I went to college looking forward to being with Jews for the first time, which I was eventually did get to be with, although in the beginning I was put in a dorm where no one else was. So I had finally found kind of a comfort level of not being the only one. And then a few months after that, I'm back again the only one. So I have this new culture shock again. And yet being a northerner, I never thought of myself as a northerner until I got to Fort Knox. I had northern opinions. So the Southern Baptist that I did share a car with, and that fictionalized part is true, my husband invited them over, we should share a car. She didn't know what a Jew was, and she had typical Southern beliefs about blacks. For example, she explained to me why they couldn't go to their swimming hole in their small town in the South because blacks went there. I said, well, why can't you go there? She said, because we can't. So, and I'll never forget when we first went to the PX to buy this Mrs. Lieutenant booklet, that a young black soldier held the door open for us. And she said, look at that, he's looking at us. I said, he's being polite, he's holding the door open. No, he's looking at us. And that was such a shock to me.
Go ahead.
That it was just a surreal world. I mean, I have to admit that I didn't realize that Puerto Rican males were subject to the draft. So, and I remember every single thing. I have all the papers. The only thing I don't remember is how I chose my entertainment committee. I was putting up my hand to be the chair, obviously, because the Southern Baptist and I shared a car. She was on the committee. I don't remember how the black and the two Puerto Ricans got on the committee, one of whom didn't speak English. So then I took those four of us, and then I changed pieces so that they're not really exactly the way. I took pieces from other people, but very much representative of time. 1970 is only 6 years after the Civil Rights Act was enacted.
Yeah.
People forget that, and they forget that the Army was not integrated units in World War II, only in the Korean War, which is only 20 years before. So there's still the Army's own segregation, I guess, history is also working.
It's interesting to put that into context like that because you know, it wasn't that long ago, but it really is a quite a different time. And your experience back then is you know, it's quite hard to believe, actually, when you put that in contrast with modern day.
I know. That's exactly why I had to write this novel, even if it took me 38 years.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's talk about some of the more modern day themes and why you feel that this book and this story is relevant today.
First, I think there's a lot of racial and religious prejudice here in the United States, forgetting how other countries view the United States. And I think it's very interesting that this presidential election is bringing it up again in ways that is probably unexpected. And I think it's important to remind people of how much people do share instead of how many differences there are.
Mm. So in particular, what issues do you see going on with the election?
I'm very careful not to talk politics with people and to take sides.
Oh, yeah, of course.
But as you know, there are, you know, the various talk about having an African-American as president, et cetera, et cetera,
mm-hmm.
or a woman.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things that also I want to talk about in the book. 1970 was just the beginning of the women's rights movement. And within a few years, all of us who were very happy to be Mrs. Mitchell Miller, I never use that now. I'm always Ms. Phyllis Zimbler Miller.
Is that right?
I love my husband. We're still married 38 years later, but I am not Mrs. Miller.
Mm-hmm. We've come a long way.
Right. But, you know, we have two daughters. They're 24 and 26. We tell them about things that they absolutely have no idea. In fact, we went to Philadelphia once, and we visited the newspaper where I worked after the Army. And I had forgotten, but the reporters there who had worked with me told my daughters that I had gotten the right for women to die in their own name. And I had totally forgotten that.
What do you mean?
Obits used to be Mrs. John Smith, nay, your maiden name was never your first name even.
Oh, my gosh.
Because, you see, it was such a, a coup, a status to be Mrs. John Smith.
Yes. And it was a very, just the, very much male-dominated back then.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So apparently I had fought the newspaper to have women die, like Shirley Smith, and then nay, and then it would be nay, her, I forget how it was shown, her husband. But anyway, we showed her that she was married to, she got all, you know, everyone got their own status, but also their own name.
You started that.
Yes. And this, it was a weekly Jewish newspaper called The Exponent in Philadelphia. But I had forgotten that.
Oh.
But in a really bizarre circumstance, this Monday, I was at an AE5 sorority function at the UCLA AE5 house. I had not been in an AE5 function since I graduated in 1969. I went through college in 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I was telling them the story of how I got keys for sororities at Michigan State, which is another example of, you know, universities were in the place of parents. When I started college, women had very strict curfews. And between the time I started in 67 and the time I graduated in 69, the world started to really change. So it was a fascinating time in terms of women finding their place in the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Where do you think women stand today, and where do we still need to go?
I came to that AFI reception from a Wharton reception. I have an MBA from Wharton.
Mm-hmm.
After the new dean spoke on his vision, I raised a question and said, what percentage of the new incoming MBA class for this fall at Wharton are women? He said 39%, and that's good. He told me the usual story, which I've heard, of why top business schools can't get women. And I wrote a blog. I write two blogs a day, and one's on Mrs. Lieutenant and one's on career advice, and emailed it to him that business schools need to promote business careers among women. Wharton's about to help 10,000 women in some third world country learn microbusiness, which is lovely, but I think maybe we should promote business among women in the United States also.
Wow, good point. Very good.
I don't think I'll be successful in convincing Wharton, and I'm trying.
Good for you. Tell us about your blogs.
I blog at Mrs. Lieutenant, the same .blogspot.com.
Okay.
About both the past and the present concerning the military and historical events. And then I blog at flippingburgersandbeyond.blogspot.com. And it's in connection with the book that I'm writing now, Advice for Teens on applying to college and their careers and internships, but not the usual, you have to get into a top school. It's the opposite. Find your passion and follow your passion.
Mm.
And that's what I write about.
How did you get into that, into coaching teens like that?
What happened is, the brief version is that I did a marketing campaign to get into Wharton, because when I went to 78, at the age of 30, that was old. Now they want women and men to wait years before going to business school,
mm-hmm.
but not at that time. So So only the military men were as old as I. So I had to do a marketing campaign to get in because I hadn't had mass since junior year of high school, not college.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, did a marketing campaign. So when my older daughter wanted to go to film school, we began to realize that you needed a marketing campaign. So we kind of conducted one for her, just by luck. Then I started learning more and more. Next daughter comes along 2 years later, applying to college. By that time, we had gotten kind of savvy, learned a lot of stuff. Finally, I realized that kids need to market themselves. They have to find who they are as a brand. They can change, this isn't written in stone, and market to the universities that meet the criteria that they want to attend. Then I started coaching people, started getting all this information, putting it together.
Mm-hmm.
And so but the truth is, I really don't like to coach individual people as much because I want them to learn to do it themselves. I'd rather give the information to people and have them do it themselves.
Follow their own path.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's exactly.
So when are you coming out with your second, with Flipping Burgers and Beyond?
Actually, I just had a change in my thinking. The book covers starting in ninth grade through past college.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's probably too wide a spread, yet everything builds. So I'm planning and putting it in small downloadable chapters so that you can choose. You go to my website. I have a website, but this isn't ready to go yet. And you can, you know, pick and choose from a menu. I think that might be more helpful for people.
I think that's a great idea.
I know. I thought of it because I've shown it to publishers and they don't get it.
Mm-hmm.
People get it. Readers get it. Publishers don't get it because they don't know where in a bookstore to put it on the shelf.
Oh, yeah.
High school, is it college?
Mm-hmm.
Then I thought of this idea a week ago. I've done all this research. I want to share. I have a lot of free information, actually, on the website for the book now, which is simply Flipping Burgers and Beyond without the blogspot.com.
Mm-hmm.
There's lots of free information to help teens. And I thought, why not do that? And I'll just put them out at a low price, and you'll pick and choose what piece of the story you want.
I think that's a great idea. So is this basically you are kind of embarking on a writing career? Is that what you're switching gears a little bit and writing books? And
to me, it's all the same. I've always written.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
And it's just the same. But now I've had to learn internet marketing.
Yeah.
An MBA from Wharton does nothing in this new world of internet marketing. I'm teaching myself, buying book after book. It's a brave new world out there.
Yeah, the internet, I mean, it's just changed basically everything in our society. So, yeah. Very interesting. I'm wondering, speaking to your new book, if it's appropriate for book clubs and discussion groups and that sort of thing.
It's very appropriate. In fact, I provide questions for free download on the homepage of my website because I would like to encourage discussion of how much racial tension there is today. Is the racial tension kind of learning to adapt to a new society? I'd love book groups to discuss it.
Can they get in touch with you as well? Do you have an email address and a contact?
Yes, it's on the website.
Okay.
pzmiller@mrslieutenant.com. Absolutely. I'd love to hear from people.
Wonderful. So this book just came out. What are you doing? Are you going to do some book signings? What are you doing in the way of promotions?
I am not doing book signings. I did that with the Jewish holiday book, and I learned long ago that was not time efficient.
Mm-hmm.
I am joining a lot of social media networking groups
and
getting my story out that way. And the blog helps, doing interviews, and just really trying to get the word out on the internet. And then hopefully people will tell other people.
Yeah. Well, it's very exciting. Very exciting for you. And I wish you all the best. And I'm just so happy that I was able to have you on the program. And just when your book came out, I mean, it's a real treat to talk to an author when their book just hit the shelves. So I just hope all the best. And I mean, this Amazon recognition really is great for you. I mean, that you must feel wonderful about that.
Yes, it's very nice. I just hope lots of people go on the site and buy the book from Amazon because that's Amazon's mathematical formulas. The more people that buy, the more people they show the book to. Very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they have a very interesting way of doing that. So Amazon is number one right now, apparently.
Absolutely, and I've read two books on this subject already. Amazing how they do it.
Mm-hmm. All right, Phyllis. Well, thank you so much for coming on the program today. You take care, and I hope to talk with you again.
Thank you. It was wonderful, Juanita. I really appreciate it.
You bet. Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right, listeners, I've been talking today with Phyllis Zimbler-Miller. Her new book, Mrs. Lieutenant, a Sharon Gold novel, just hit shelves. Check it out. It is, as I mentioned earlier, a semi-finalist in the Amazon Breakthrough Novel Award, and I think that this book is definitely going places. So do go to Phyllis's website, MrsLieutenant.com. Check out all the information she has up there, her two blogs, and just pass on the word for this wonderful novel. Thanks again for tuning in to Inside Scoop Live. I'm Juanita Watson, and until next time.